Welcome to New Realities. My name is Alan Steinfeld, and each week I bring what I think is the latest in a spiritually evolving tradition that's happening here in this country, and authors and speakers and teachers who are bringing out new material to lead us into a new age, a new time, a new consciousness. But tonight we have a very interesting Christmas show, and the first guest has just written a book called The Star of the Magi, which I think is appropriate for today, The Mystery That Heralded the Coming of Christ. And this is all about the Magi's of Persia and their origins and who they were and why they supposedly were at the birth of Jesus. The author's name is Courtney Roberts. And Courtney, you're there, right?
Yes. Hello, Alan, and Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you. So I do think this is an appropriate book for today, even though it really wasn't the birth of Jesus, December 25th, was it?
Well, close enough, I suppose.
But I really love this book because it is everything I've always liked about these types. It is very academic historically with an overview of the Middle East, which I think is really fascinating, the history of the Middle East. And then it had a lot of theological information about the Gospel of Matthew and all the stuff that the religions of Christianity has been built up on, and you actually gave me some different ideas about Judaism and Christianity. I mean, I was brought up Jewish, and I didn't realize that there was such a split between what was then Israel and Judea after King Solomon's kingdom split. It split into two kingdoms. The north was called Israel and the south was called Judea. And you say they had two different gods. I think that's very interesting. That the Bible then tried to integrate into one and the same.
Exactly. You know, you're right. We are going through a major religious revolution at this point, and I think you know, we've got access to so much more material than anyone's ever had at any single point before, and we've got access to so many more texts than any one place and time, and we've got so many great scholars working all this that we're really revolutionizing everything that you know, we ever thought or were taught about religion before. And what we're finding is a lot of these, you know, kind of accepted assumptions underlying our general idea of the Judeo-Christian tradition, they're really very medieval. They're based on a very limited, you know, apprehension of what was really going on at the time. And some of these texts are, you know, deliberately manipulated to give a certain impression of things as they really weren't. So it's important that we reexamine all of this and that we do take to heart a lot of the new findings. And, it's absolutely, I think, a very well-documented historical fact that Israel and Judea were two very different nations and peoples.
And worship two different gods, which is what you bring out here.
Absolutely.
What were these different gods that they worshipped?
The God of Israel was El, hence the name. And in all of the parts of the Old Testament that actually derive from the northern territories of Israel, you see this name over and over again. And El was originally a Canaanite deity, the head deity or father god of the ancient Canaanite pantheon, and he had this whole family or, you know, pantheon of gods that he ruled over, and they were quite diverse, and El was always the kingly father figure sitting on the throne, the bearded old man on the throne, the original bearded man.
That's where we get that image from, huh?
I mean, really think so, and it stayed with us because it's a wonderful image. He's kind of remote and kindly and above it all, but he's the progenitor, the father figure on the throne. Now, that's completely different from Yahweh. Yahweh, who we usually think of as, you know, God and the God of Judea, he was from the south, and he arose in the deserts to the south of Judea, moving into, you know, actually Arabia. And Yahweh was like a dramatic action hero compared to
He says, I'm an angry God. He actually says that somewhere in the Bible,
well,
doesn't he?
He's the war God. He's the war God.
Right.
He's you know, young and virile, and he's a storm God. He moves on the mountaintops, and he's like the thunder and lightning flashing in the storms. But he's mainly a war God and a tribal war God who would be sworn to protect the interest of his patron tribe, and he'd fly before his troops in his chariot. You know, this is the whole origin of the idea of the ark. They had to have the ark going before them into battle because that meant, you know, Yahweh was with them going into battle. So these were very different gods with very different ideologies. And we've always been taught that, well, in the Bible, there's all these different names for God. No, there's all these different gods.
Huh. Do you go along with Zacharias Sitchin's belief that these were actually beings that came from another planet and enslaved humanity to do their deeds and genetically manipulated us to be who we are?
The short answer would be no. I'm not exactly an adherent of Sitchin, but I'd also say we don't really know, and I think there's a lot of history bound up in these myths and stories, but there's a lot of mythology. What the actual process within the human psyche and soul of creating these ancient pantheons are, we've never clearly defined that, and I think it needs more work.
I mean, are there, could there actually be these gods or beings that are, let's say, supernatural in nature, that seem, you know, that are out there that we're not perceiving in an ordinary reality?
Well, I think that's a fair question. You know, it's something I dealt with at length in my earlier book on the visions of the Virgin. I think the modern, you know, post-Jungian way of or post-modern post-Jungian way of dealing with us is to say, well, it's all this unconscious projection of our own.
But I think that is I don't agree.
No, I think there's actually a simpler explanation that there could be these actual beings out there that we're interacting with, and on some level, I think both of those positions are true. We really need to examine that more.
I think that is actually the most intelligent of positions. The fact that these both are true—they're deep subconscious primeval forces within our own psyche and there's a true exterior reality of supernatural existences. I mean, Patrick Harper's book, Daemonic Reality, talks about that. Do you know that book?
No, I'm not familiar with it, but I am familiar with the concept. Yes, yeah, and I think it's easy to dismiss all of that as, you know, some archaic projection, but you know, there are other forces, and we don't perceive them completely, we don't perceive them clearly, but our mythology at least, you know, struggles with trying to perceive them. I think that's also the basis of the astrological model of consciousness as well, that, as you said, they're parts of ourselves. You know, they're within us and they're out there at the same time.
Well, that's a really good point, because I think astrology is exactly that. Astrology is a sort of, let's say, worship of forces that seem to be in us but are also ruled by things outside of us.
Yeah.
So, exactly. So, within that astrological model, then, you talk about the great cycle here of the Jupiter-Saturn conjunction bringing in the heralding of new ages, in a sense, would you say?
Well, certainly it's clear to me that that's what the Persian Magi believed in at the time of the birth of Christ, and I think perhaps it's a difference between...
Right,
yes?
I want you to speak much more.
Okay. Oh, I'm over. Okay.
That was just a note from the producer.
Okay, thanks. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's one of the biggest differences, I think, between my book, The Star of the Magi, and any of the research that's been done before. I actually, examine the Persian Magi and what kind of religion they practiced, what kind of astrology they practiced, and how they united their astrology and religion, and how influential it was on the Judeans. And when you actually do that, and mind you, no authors have actually done this before, which seems kind of ironic, but it's true. would actually do that. Yeah, the Persians were very interested in the cycle of Jupiter-Saturn conjunctions, and it's a beautiful cycle. I mean, it traces out this incredible pattern of interlacing triangles across the zodiac, and it, by their calculations, the cycle lasted almost exactly 1,000 years or a millennium, and that was their other main concern, was the millenniums. And so they believed that this routinely and psychically brought about the rise and fall of new empires, new dynasties, but also the rise and fall of great prophets and new religions and new ages, and ultimately, the end of the world and the beginning of a whole new aeon.
So when are we expecting the next of that conjunction? When does it come up again?
Well, you know, the kind of conjunction that the Magi were responding to at the time of Christ, I don't know if that ever will happen again. It was quite a unique time. And looking back historically, it does really stand out in the whole course of world history as a very unique time with very unique.
Why is that? Can you explain why that was so unique, that particular conjunction?
Well, there's two ways to answer that. I mean, was it the conjunction that brought it about, or was it the fact that it was so much upheaval in that time that people projected on the conjunction, or some combination of both? But, you know, we still divide time with a line running right through those ages between B.C. and A.D.
We still
divide time that way. And as you read the early Christian literature, there is this one very undeniable truth that comes through all the literature, and even, you know, very much in the words of Christ, that these people really believed that they were living at the end of the world, and that everything they knew of the ancient world was about to pass away and be replaced by this whole new age and this whole new coming kingdom of God.
And they were absolutely right. I mean, you know,
in some
sense, the destruction of the temple, the second temple, was the ending of a whole phase for the Jews and the beginning of Christianity.
It also coincided with the rise of the Roman Empire, and there were just and the death of paganism, the death of the ancient religions and the polytheism of the ancient world. It was just a tremendous time of change. And in the kind of astrology that the Magi practiced, again, all the indicators were pointing to the fact that this was the beginning of a whole new age and the beginning of a whole new era, and that they should expect a great new prophet and a great new religion and indeed a great new empire. And all of that occurred. And it's only when we really look at the astrology of the Magi that we see the reckoning behind that. That was obviously, you know, people were talking and thinking about this.
Well, they're thinking about it now, though, again, you know, to 2012, 2000. I mean, just before we get to the Magi, when is the actual next conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn?
Well, now, the conjunctions occur every 20 years, like clockwork. But there are certain phases in the conjunction cycle that are presumably more important than others. The last really important one was the conjunction in 1981, primarily because it was a shift from the Earth signs to the Air signs. It was very anomalous, so it was very unique. It was a triple conjunction, too. But that coincided with a major revolution among the Persian people and the beginning of a new dynasty, because that was the Iranian Revolution and the beginning of the Islamic Republic of Iran. But it was also the beginning of the real conservative era in American politics. It was the beginning of the Reagan administration.
That's right. It's interesting how Iran and Babylonia, Iraq, and Persia, and they're all still, they're in the news. I mean, this book is, in a way, a kind of prelude, in a sense, to where we are now. I mean,
I think my book is very much an attempt to really, you know, answer definitively a lot of the questions about the Star of Bethlehem, but also to point out in the process that, you know, we're at war with the Persians. They are kind of our traditional enemies, and there's a lot of, you know, really important questions we need to be asking about why, and what do we really know about these people, and why do we feel this knee-jerk reaction to hate them, when in fact, if we examine the evidence, they've made huge contributions to our culture and our religion, which we habitually ignore, and what's up with all that?
Well, who says they're our traditional enemies? According to your book, they were the ones that really gave the Jews, the Judeo-Christian, origins. They backed their kingdom after the Babylonians wiped them out.
Right, but when was the last time anybody talked about that in a church or a synagogue?
Well, I agree, but I think that's because they always talk about the destruction of the first temple. They don't realize, I mean, they don't talk about, although isn't Purim, the Jewish holiday of Purim, a celebration of the return
It is a holiday they picked up, during the exile, and it's definitely got Persian overtones to it. But it's about Esther, and basically
her
Esther
brother.
Saving the Jews when the Babylonians were trying to hurt them again in Babylon. Now, see, we're in the Western Judeo-Christian tradition. We have different cultural heroes. Our cultural heroes are the Greeks and the Romans.
Right.
You know, that's when we talk about a classical education, that's where we start. And there's a lot of underlying assumptions there that the Greeks invented civilization and science, and then they passed it on to the Romans, and it came to us. Similarly, in religion, we start with Judea. You know, we just kind of unconsciously think that Judea, well, they discovered God, or God discovered them, and that's where religion starts, you know. But this is just the Western Judeo tradition. It's not supported by the evidence.
Well, that's exactly a great point you bring down in your book. First of all, that the Greeks got a lot of their knowledge probably from Babylonia and the Chaldeans, and also that fact that Abraham comes out of Babylon. These are two different strands contributing to Western civilization that come from that part of the world, not the Greeks. They predate the Greeks.
There's very important cultural reasons why we habitually fail to credit the Mesopotamians for these discoveries, and we habitually credit the Greeks, when in fact the Greeks got them from the Mesopotamians. You see, whenever the Greek Empire or the Roman Empire tried to push east, they ran up against the great empires of the ancient Near East. They ran up against the Babylonians, and then they ran up against the Persians. And the greatest enemies of the Greeks were the Persians, and the greatest enemies, the Romans, were the Persians. And they could never conquer their territory. And we always talk in the West about how great Rome was. But who knows about the Persian Empire? They were great. And in the ancient world, you know, Judea was a tiny wee nation. It really wasn't very important. Persia was important. But they were the traditional enemies of the Greeks, and because we've inherited that tradition, we have, in a sense, inherited their traditional enemies. And that underlies a lot of the animosity between East and West, and the Christian West, and the Muslim Middle East.
And do you think those politics are still in play right now with our anti-Iranian...
Absolutely.
Isn't that amazing?
Unthinkingly, we are unthinkingly being manipulated into seeing these people as these, you know, horrible enemies and these barbarians, when in fact they're much more afraid of us. And they have a lot of good reason to be.
Oh, yeah. No, I know. Well, it's the same thing with the Cold War. The Russians were a lot more afraid of the Americans and, you know, than the Americans had to be against the Russians. That's what destroyed eventually their economy, was our constant military pressure to keep up with the Americans. I mean, so it's a vast manipulation politics, but I do like that you give a really balanced sense of history here, because there's so much that we can learn from you know, the other side of history, because, you know, it has been written by the Greeks that we've inherited, and now you're kind of bringing back in this other angle, and the fact that you make a good point that they sent the Judeans back to their kingdom, or when Darius said to the Jews or the Hebrews or the Israelites, whatever you want to call them, they could return. It was really to buffer the Persians from the Egyptians, wasn't it? Because that was their biggest threat.
The Persians rebuilt Judea from nothing. The Babylonians wiped them out, destroyed Jerusalem, destroyed the temple, sent anybody who was anybody into captivity in Babylon. It was Cyrus the Great, and the Persian Empire that sent them back. And they didn't just liberate them from Babylon. They gave them the protection and the funds to rebuild the Jerusalem colony, to rebuild the temple, etc. And the Bible's very clear on this point. But we have to understand the Persians weren't just being, you know, generous or charitable.
Right.
They had very definite aims and goals in solidifying their own borders of this, you know, vast empire that they'd accumulated. This was a really humane and far-sighted way of building stable and loyal colonies to defend the borders. So in rebuilding the temple, in rebuilding the religion that was practiced at the temple, there was a tremendous amount of Persian input into what went on there. And it's at that point in the history of Judaism that you see this sudden infusion of Persian ideas, specifically the dualism between God and the devil, you know, where they're constantly feuding. You have a good God and an evil devil. That's Persian religion.
That's Zoroastrian,
yes,
right?
Yes, that is the monotheistic dualism of Zoroastrianism. Mm-hmm. Also, the whole idea that this battle between good and evil is all leading up to an ultimate battle at the end of the world, at the end of time, where the forces of good will defeat the forces of evil forever and usher in a whole new aeon. These ideas are very familiar to us in Judaism and Christianity, but they're not Jewish and they're not Christian. They're from the Persian religion.
Right.
And we have the very clear lines of transmission from the Persian religion into Judaism through the building of the Second Temple.
That's an amazing history that's totally been ignored and forgotten.
Yeah.
It was also to buffer the borders with Egypt, right? Because wasn't that Persia's biggest threat in that part of the world?
Well, Persia had taken Egypt. But Egypt was, you know, hard to hold. So they had a massive invasion planned during the reign of Darius. And, in fact, that really triggered the actual building of the Second Temple in 515 and 516 B.C. It coincided with Darius's planned invasion of Egypt. Now, he had to move a massive army from Persia through Judea into Egypt. So that outpost of Jerusalem as a supply center, as a tax center, as a revenue center, was absolutely central to Darius's plans for Egypt.
Wait. Oh, so when did the Persians go into Egypt? What year was that about?
It was at the same time of the rededication of the Second Temple. It was between 520 and 510.
And then how long were they in Egypt for, the Persians? How long did they?
They held Egypt off and on for the next couple of hundred years. And Egypt
hard
to hold. Yeah, Egypt was hard to hold. But there was Persian rulership there. And it was wonderful because it opened up, you know, a lot of interaction and commerce between Egypt and Babylon. So it was a great age for astronomy and astrology.
And sciences.
These centers were in contact, and you suddenly, Darius totally renovated the entire calendar. You had this wonderful, huge leaps forward in mathematical astronomy because you had this great exchange between these two great centers of learning.
Wait, so the first temple was destroyed in what,
586 B.C.
And then, so it was only really about 70 years that they were captive.
Yes.
But in that time, they had the Jewish religion or books were totally wiped out in that time?
Apparently so. That's what the scriptures tell us. In fact, the scriptures tell us that the new Jerusalem colonists that the Persians sent back, they were in the colony of Jerusalem for nearly 100 years before Ezra and Nehemiah even showed up with the scriptures.
But there must have been
people
who. Well, it seems a little. But there must have been people who remembered the old scriptures, who had some copies, or there must have been hidden somewhere, don't you think? Or the Torah, you know, itself must have had some.
Well, I dare say there were. But it's interesting how that tradition has developed, because according to the Bible, they didn't have anything. It was all burned with the temple. And Ezra and Nehemiah brought the law from Babylon at the order of the Persian emperor. And when they gathered all the people in Jerusalem to read the law out to them, it was all surprisingly new to them. They'd never heard this stuff before.
And where was that totally Persian influence then?
Well, I don't think it was totally Persian influence because, you know, you can look at the books of the Bible, and obviously there's much older literature in there. So obviously somebody either had retain the oral tradition, or they had some scrolls or tablets stashed away somewhere. But at the same time, there was a major editing process, and that's where, you know, if you use the documentary hypothesis where you've got E and you've got J, this is where R comes in, the redactor, the editor. And there's
right.
a major editing process that goes on during this period.
Huh. Now let's go to the main question here, which I think is, who were the Magi? How did they develop their science and their astrology, and who were they, and why? And they must have really have been prophets. And what was the meaning of the gifts that they brought to Jesus? You know. So let's answer. Who were they?
Well, the Magi were very, very well known throughout the ancient world because they were, in fact, the official priesthood of the imperial Persian religion. So wherever the Persian Empire went, which was everywhere, the Magi were there in powerful administrative positions. They were always close to the emperor, always close to the source of power. Now, they were a hereditary priestly caste. They actually date back to the ancient tribes of Media, which is the region around the South Caspian Sea. We probably call it Kurdistan nowadays.
I see.
And they were originally the hereditary priestly tribe of the Medians. Once the Medians were conquered by the Persians, which was 6th century, they became the official priestly caste, as I said, of the imperial Persian religion. They were the masters of knowledge, the masters of wisdom, the masters of religion and ritual. And they were also closely allied with the Chaldeans in Babylon from at least the 8th century on. So they were also renowned throughout the ancient world as cracking astrologers.
Mm-hmm. So how did they develop that knowledge and that wisdom? And do we have a source for, like, the origins of the Magi's, you know, traditions?
Well, we do have a number of sources. I wish I could say that we had 8th and 7th century texts of theirs, but we don't. A lot of that material was destroyed in the invasions of Alexander and also destroyed in the Muslim invasions.
Right.
However, we do have a lot of tablets from Babylon and Assyria where they were very active, and we can trace the rise of mathematical astronomy and mathematical astrology in the 7th and 6th centuries B.C., and the Magi were always right in the thick of it, along with the Assyrians and with the Chaldeans in Babylon. Once the Persian Empire conquered Babylon, which was 539 B.C., the Magi were actually put in supervisory position over the Chaldeans in Babylon, and that was that began the golden age of mathematical astronomy. Suddenly they figured out the planetary orbits. They made amazing advances over the next 50 years.
And the Chaldeans were the priesthood of the Babylonians.
Yeah, they were the great observers of the ancient world.
So was Abraham part of that Chaldean family that then moved, Abraham the father of the...
Look, the Bible says Abraham came from Ur of the Chaldees, but, I mean, that's what the Bible says, for what it's worth. Abraham is a mythical figure. You know,
is he?
Many, many ancient tribes claim Abraham as a father. That's what the word means, great father, Abraham.
Oh, right.
So Abraham wasn't just the father of the Judeans. He was the father of the Edomites, of the Keturites, of all those tribes around there going way down into Arabia. I mean, even Mecca and Medina claim to have been founded by Abraham.
Mm-hmm.
But there's certain scholars that say that Abraham and Sarah in the biblical tradition are the Indian gods Brahma and Sarasvati.
Oh, that makes sense, doesn't it?
These are myths. These are legends of a great father.
Well, they may be legends, but then you have to then say that all that whole Jewish patriarchy is a legend from, you know, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, all the way down to Moses, perhaps.
Well, one of the things we've learned in the last century is we have to deal with those eventualities. You know, since the foundation of the state of Israel after World War II, they've undertaken massive archaeological explorations to try, you know, to prove that the biblical history is true and that the, you know, the Israelis have some, you know, historical right to be there. And what they've actually done at the end of the day, we're sorting all this out. But at the end of the day, they've actually proven exactly the opposite. That not only are the stories not necessarily supported by the archaeological evidence, but in fact the archaeological evidence tells a different story. And a better story, a more inclusive story, a less divisive story, a less ethnocentric story, as we might imagine.
Right. Interesting. So there must have been what I'm trying to say here is real sense of prophecy and magic and wisdom that the Magi had in their astrological and prophetic traditions, right? I mean, it seems
they had great reputations as seers and wise men, and specifically, you know, the Magi, when we say they practice astrology, I think we have to step back from our contemporary definition of what astrology was. They weren't doing sun sign columns, you know, they weren't saying, Leo, you are magnanimous and generous, you should marry Sagittarius. You know, that's not what we're talking about here. They had these vast cosmological and chronological schemes. They really believed in this ongoing battle between good and evil, and that it was all adding up to this battle at the end of the world. And they had this whole astrological program that showed you exactly how and when it was going to unfold. They also believed that as part of this program, that the good God would be sending at regular intervals these world saviors, these deliverers, these messiahs into the world to speed the process along, to spread goodness, to restore righteousness, to, you know, bring people back to the good religion. So this was the dawn of a lot of our, you know, messianic ideas, and this was all encoded and foretold in the Magi's astrology. So they were really doing very big picture cosmic stuff, and that's why it was imperative for the author of Matthew to put them in his gospel, to open his gospel, to show that the birth of Jesus Christ fit into this large system.
Because the Jews at that time were very much influenced by the Persian astrology.
Yes, and they were allied with the Persians against the Romans. The Persians were their main support and ally against the Roman occupation.
Were the Romans occupying Persia at that point, too?
Oh, no. Persia was fine and grand. Persia had their own dynasty, and they had an empire, and they had the Magi as their imperial priesthood. It was Judea, a little old tiny Judea, just a tiny wee nation that was occupied by the Romans and couldn't shake them. And the Persians had been their constant support in their insurrection, and the Persian astrology was, you know, a main source of hope and inspiration to them that, you know, they could overthrow these evil foreign invaders and restore a God-given Jewish king to the throne with a whole new dynasty and a whole new Messiah. This is all, they shared the same ideology.
So if you you're conversant in Persian astrology, would you say? Because what would you, if you were to know Persian astrology, would you then make that same prophecy that this was a time where a being would be born that would change the planetary spiritual politics? Could you see that from their astrology?
Well, that, you know, I'd love to just give you a quick answer and say, oh,
no,
yeah,
I
certainly,
know.
You know. But,
no, your whole book is about, no, I know.
Yeah,
but, yes.
And I think, you know, what I'd rather emphasize is that, you know, we actually have texts that preserve for us the Persian traditions of the Magi and the way that the Persians practice this kind of religious astrology. And what they preserve for us is, as I said, these two systems of the Jupiter-Saturn conjunctions and the millenniums, the way they aligned with the start of the millenniums. And that is what they use in the texts that have come down to us to show not only the coming of Christ and the coming of Christianity, but also the coming of Muhammad and the coming of Islam. Because this was part of their overall system, that God was going to send these saviors to spread the good religion, and that's how they see both Christ and Muhammad. By the way, they also use the same system to unite the birth of Christ and the coming of Christianity with the dawn of the Roman Empire.
Oh.
Think about that. You see, that's very interesting. Even at that early phase, they were uniting the fortunes of Christianity with the power of Rome. It's a very interesting system.
That then actually did come into play, you know, eventually, a couple hundred years later.
Yeah, and in that Persian system, it's all quite coherent and quite consistent.
So they were incredible astrologers then, if they were to predict all that. And that,
well,
I mean,
if they predicted it or even if they figured it out, you know, we're not exactly sure when they got all those ideas in play. And by the way, the story in the Gospel of Matthew about the Magi, and that's the only place the story appears, most scholars think it's probably the latest part of the Gospel of Matthew. It probably wasn't even added until after the destruction of Jerusalem, maybe 80 A.D.
Uh-huh.
So by then they'd had a good 80 years to kind of figure a lot of this stuff out. Okay?
Mm.
So whether they actually predicted it all beforehand or if they, you know, took 80 years to think about it and project that, they were still wonderful astrologers. And I think they had a very inspiring worldview with sacred time and sacred cosmology. And it's a shame we've lost that because it's really inspiring.
But by 80 A.D., they already saw that the footprints, the handwriting was on the wall, the destruction of the Second Temple, the rise of the dictatorship, you know, in Rome was already in place by 80, and so it all was coming into play.
Yeah, and they were pulling the pieces together. They were big picture people, definitely.
But that was just for the West. They must have had different predictions for their own Persian empires and what was happening there, because it was,
well,
you know,
the fate of the Roman Empire had everything to do with the fate of their own Persian Empire, because they were constantly fighting that border with Rome. And by the way, the Persians always did remarkably well against the Romans. That's why the Romans never expanded into the ancient Near East. They were always running up against the Persians, and the Persians could take them.
Well, what about Alexander the Great? He had a hard time with them, or did he kind of made it through?
He did penetrate. He did conquer Persia. The problem with Alexander is that, you know, he conquered an empire, but he didn't live to rule it.
Right.
He died almost immediately afterwards, and the ancient world was fractured by the feuding between his generals into small empires. But, you know, Alexander was Macedonian, but he was representing the Greek cause, and the great Persian Empire of Cyrus the Great had conquered Greece. And Greece really resented that, and they waited 150 years, 200 years to get their revenge, and that came in Alexander. So when he penetrated beyond Babylon, he destroyed the Persian Empire. He burned Persepolis. He tried to destroy the Magi.
He was getting back for when the Persians invaded Athens and destroyed
that.
But one last question, because we can continue this conversation next week too, but the Magi actually brought these gifts to Jesus that were born, and they seemed like they were gifts of initiation. Were they hoping to somehow impart the knowledge of the Magi to this Messiah, possible Messiah being, if he really existed?
Well, Matthew does tell us that they brought three gifts, the gold, the frankincense, and the myrrh. By the way, he doesn't tell us that there were three wise men or three Magi.
Mm.
He says there were plural, there was more than one.
Uh-huh.
But they brought the three gifts, the gold, frankincense, and the myrrh. Now, whether they meant to initiate him, I'm not sure. I think they perceived that he was already pretty far along in his spiritual development to be coming in at such a time. But these were very, on the one hand, they were kingly gifts, they were royal gifts of gold, but they were also priestly gifts. You know, the frankincense and the myrrh, this is the kind of incense that you burn in religious services. If you've ever gone to a high Catholic mass or a good proper Anglican Episcopalian mass, that wonderful incense that they burn, that's frankincense and myrrh. And when you get a whiff of that, it just elevates your senses. It takes you right away to a higher place. And these are the tools of the priesthood. So on the one hand, they were looking for a king. They came looking for the new king of Judea, but it was a God-sent king who was also a high priest, and they brought the priestly gifts as well. That's my take on it. If we want the real answer, we'd have to dig up Matthew and ask him.
But there are still magi living, you said in the book.
We do have Zoroastrian communities, they do have their priesthood, but, they've been very persecuted, and their numbers are quite small, so they don't necessarily have the same hereditary priesthood of the Magi. The Muslims took care of that, by and large. But they do still have Zoroastrian priests, yes.
Well, Courtney, let's pick up this conversation next week. Do you mind, then?
Oh,
that'd be lovely. We can also talk about the visions of the Virgin Mary, which I also, from an astrological analysis of divine intercession.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Okay, I've been talking to Courtney Roberts, the author of The Star of the Magi, a very interesting book full of history and theology and astrology, a great combination of both, and thank you, Courtney.
Well, thank you, Ellen. It's been great.
Yes. And I look forward to next week. I'm going to talk to this other guest I have scheduled as well. So thank you.
Well, thank you, and I'll talk to you again soon. And have a wonderful New Year.
Thank you. You too. Thank you.
Okay.
I thank you for listening to New Reality. I have another guest scheduled for tonight named Leanne Scruggs.
Hello?
Leanne.
Hi.
Hi, thanks for being a guest on the show tonight.
Thank you for having me.
How do you pronounce your last name?
Craigs.
Scruggs.
C-R-A-G-G-S, Craigs.
Oh, good. Well, thank you so much for, I would love to get into, we were just talking about the whole, feeling of this holiday and what's it all about and the kind of different time we're moving into. You've been having some very interesting experiences with these things called orbs of light. And I've done three shows on that, but I'd love to add your commentary about what's happening with. Do you want to describe your journey with these beings and what you see?
Tell us where...
What happened to you?
It started in March 2004. I was in Cabo San Lucas in a family home that we have there, and I was up on the roof going to take a tent down because I stay up on the roof in a tent, and I was going to San Diego to work and was venturing out to take the tent out before I flew back to San Diego, and me and a girlfriend saw something flying out of the sky, which we thought was a bat. Because it was just at sunset, and so we both kind of ducked, and this thing flew between these two nets that I have that were holding a tarp down. So it's two fishing nets with a tarp between it, and that energy flew between the nets, and we realized that it wasn't a bat, and it was something else.
It was a dark energy.
Huh?
It was a dark-looking energy.
Yeah, you could clearly see that it was something. I mean, we could see that it was something. And we were quite surprised when we saw more of these energies coming down, and I don't know why that I see them, but it lasted for about 3.5 hours.
Uh-huh.
And I could see about 150,000 of them lined up in the sky.
But they were dark. They were dark or light?
It was getting dark, so, I mean, but they were darker and lighter, I guess. I mean, I don't know how to explain it. It was like a mirage of seeing things, but I don't know why that I see them so clearly, but they came down, and it was pretty much to touch my fingers, and we lay down on the roof. We sat in chairs. We danced. We, after 3.5 hours, looked at each other and said, "Something is crazy," and she took off, and...
But your friends felt something as well. It wasn't just you, right?
Yeah, she saw and actually felt something. And then I didn't see her for about a year after that. And when I went to San Diego the next day, the energies have followed me there and have been following me ever since. Though I talked to her a year after she came to my house, and I asked her if anything had happened to her, and nothing, she didn't see anything.
Mm.
So
they started... they started to come, and you felt them when you they touched your fingers, and you started to feel.
I could see them also. Like, I could see them, like, they were, I could see my girlfriend standing there, and I could see them going along her body, and then, like, when they came up to the top of her hair, I could see her hair standing up,
uh-huh.
And it was like they were checking us out, and they started out smaller ones in the beginning and then got bigger as the night progressed.
And you never saw anything like this before, huh?
No, no. I didn't have electricity at my house in Cabo yet.
Uh-huh.
I just got electricity about a year and a half ago, and so I didn't have electricity, and the next day when my girlfriend came to pick me up, I said, Vicky, I had this amazing experience on my roof last night. I'm not sure what it was, and she said, well, that's kind of funny because the Mexican Air Force also reported something and filmed something in the sky that night that I
and
had
that,
my...
That was the night they had UFOs on their radar.
Right, that, yeah, that they that, actually that. Saw that, yeah.
So then this has been a whole beginning of a journey of transformation for you.
Yeah, I was running scared for about a year and a half because, like I said, I didn't have electricity, and so I didn't quite know what it was, even though I knew that I was seeing things. And from the very beginning of that week, well, it wasn't all that good. I can't say that the first year and a half experiencing the orbs was good because I didn't really get a good response from people that I knew.
But how was your feeling inside yourself? What was your feeling?
Well, I was really scared, actually,
right.
Because I think even the first week I could see them. I've been having inner body experiences happening, and then even in that first week, I had a whole week of crazy things happening to me. And
like what? Like what kind of crazy?
Well, I could feel that they were going inside me. I could see them, like, on my layers of skin.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, my friends thought I was nuts, you know. My parents thought that I was on drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really scary. People, you know, talk about institutionalizing people when they're not all that normal. But I had a couple experiences that were really strange. But one that was pretty outrageous was I was taking a bath because I figured that I needed to take a bubble bath.
Right.
And as I laid in the bathtub, the bubbles did not decline. They ended up being like 6 feet high in the shower. So I thought that was kind of weird that they could actually go in the water. And like I said, even at that time, I had no idea really what it was. And it wasn't until a year and a half later that somebody said, I think I have what you're looking for on the Internet.
Uh-huh.
And sure enough, it was what I was seeing and experiencing.
Which was these orbs.
Which were these orbs, which I always call them the British. I'd be like, the British are coming, because one of my favorite movies is Breakfast at Tiffany's, and so I was like associating my orbs, calling them the British. So when I would see them, I'd say, oh, the British are here, the British are up there, and the Brit, you know.
So they would come every day for a whole year before you actually had any evidence of what they could be, huh?
Yeah, they did, and I was also, you know, I've been having inner body things, but I really fought that for a long time. I was trying to get a guy in Mexico who a friend suggested that I might call him. His name was Jaime Mausen.
Oh, yeah.
And so,
he's a major UFO investigator. I've met him, and he does all the cases in Mexico, all the interesting...
Right. Well, he didn't want to help me because I didn't have any photos of these energies, and I'd tried to take pictures of them and wasn't able to get it. And then I had a birthday party, and my friends stayed at the house for about 3 days, and about 2 weeks after, I got an email said that, oh, your friends are here, and they sent me, you know, about 30 pictures that had the orbs in them, you know, lots of orbs, you know, more than 100 or 200, you know.
Well, that's what I'd love to do with you, because I've been taking lots of pictures of orbs. You know, I had this orb conference in New York, and I would love to photograph and see if it matches what you're seeing in around you.
In terms of, yeah, it would be interesting to, I mean, when I had the party, I thought, oh, you know, if nobody shows up, the orbs are here, you know, but, you know, 2 weeks later, it was nice to know that, you know, my friends were able to see that they were there and that I'm not altogether nuts.
No, but you're not seeing them all the time. They come and go, right?
Yeah, and they're here with me right now, actually.
They are. Can you describe what you're seeing right now?
I see like a mirage. It looks kind of like a gray area, but I can see, like when I look at it, most of them look like a tornado on the TV. Like if you're looking at the hurricane station and you see, I mean, not a tornado, a hurricane. So it's got that massive, like, inside core with the energies rolling around it, but it's going so fast. You know what I mean? And if I put my hand out, like, which I'll do right now, I can get it to come down to me.
Are they coming down?
Yeah, they are.
Are they listening? Do you get a sense that they're intelligent and listening to the conversation and feeling?
Well, this is another experience I could tell you that I had after I was talking to that guy, Hami Mouse, and I was calling him because I was seeing quite a few orbs, and I had a inner body experience, one that was really crazy. I walked into my house one night, and it was just about sunset also, and I got stopped right in the doorway, and it felt like, I mean, I could see it like this, like gray matter going into my hand, and then I had these white powders coming out of my hands, and my hair must have been standing up straight, and I walked in, and I told my mom, I don't know what happened. I just felt like 150,000 of something just flew in me and then flew out me.
You had white powder come out of your, manifest out of your hand, actually?
And I could see this powder coming out of my hands, you know, and I mean, so many things have happened that...
Did the powder have a smell like a roses? Because in India,
no,
that's a...
No, I didn't smell anything. I just thought, wow, this is crazy. What does this mean? You know, I had no idea what it meant.
Wow.
I mean, I still really don't. I haven't really gotten so many answers, but...
Has that happened again to you?
Well, then I had another experience, which was about 2 weeks later after that, and it was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and I was trying to call this guy, Hami Mousen, because I could see thousands of them at 2 o'clock in the afternoon outside my kitchen window, and as I was talking to him, he said, I'm sorry that he couldn't help me, and so I hung up, and I looked out the window, and I said, what do you guys want? Well, they ended up flying into the window and walked me, like, to the center of my kitchen and started taking me through this movement, and I was just crying my eyes out and saying to myself, this can't be real, this isn't really happening.
Well, you could have resisted the movement if you wanted
to. Yeah, but by this time, I had already been followed by these things for quite a long time, and so I really wanted to know what they wanted.
Uh-huh.
And I knew that there was some reason why they were following me and all the other experience that I had, it scared me, but, I mean, it was in the middle of the daytime, and I was thinking, oh, gosh, you know, what could possibly happen? Well, after about 15 minutes of me going through this movement of my body going up and down and around, and all of a sudden something really deep inside of me adjusted,
uh-huh.
And at the same time I was crying, I was thanking them, and then the telephone rang, and they didn't let me pick up that time, but the phone rang again, and I picked up the phone. It was my girlfriend from Los Angeles who had, you know, already gone through a bunch of orb stories with me, even though she didn't really think I was that crazy, but I don't really think a lot of people believe me at the times.
Mm-hmm.
And I told her all the things that were happening to me, and then I hung up, and this is one thing that happened that was really crazy. But they walked me to the mirror in the kitchen, and they said, like, I couldn't really hear voices, but subliminally, I could hear them. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm listening. Yeah.
I could hear them saying, you know, we're not hurting you, you're okay. And then I started hearing this song, and it was this song by The Who. Heal me, feel me, touch me, that song. And I was
going, I am
nuts. I mean, I was bawling my eyes out.
Uh-huh.
And then I woke up about 5 hours later.
Uh-huh.
And
you felt better? Energized?
Yeah, I mean, it was a release for me to finally, you know, I mean, I have these things following me. It's almost like being stalked by something that you can't explain. Nobody else can see it, and is it real? And I was really grateful when I saw it on the internet that, I mean, I went for 2 years to have my head checked, my eyes checked, because I had a serious golf injury where a guy hit me from a line drive on a tee-off and almost killed me. So a lot of people thought that that might be something connected on why I'm seeing these.
But that was years before, right?
Yeah, that was years before, and I really don't think it has anything to do with it, but a lot of people thought that maybe possibly that was the reason, and so that's why I continued to go to California and have everything checked out, and each time the doctors would hear my story, then they would check me again, like the eye doctor, to see if I had anything floating in there or...
Right, but let's say there's nothing wrong with you, except actually there's something really right with you, that you're opening up to a higher dimension of reality. What Are you just one of the first ambassadors to this other realm? What do you think they're trying to do? I mean, they're healing you, but are they here for everybody? They seem to be around in the photographs, everyone, or lots
right,
of people.
Right, you know, and that's the one thing that I, you know, when I went to Sedona for that conference to find out
the
other
orb
people's stories.
Yeah.
And really what I found out was I'm pretty much one of the only people that was there, or one of the only ones that actually sees these things. And I haven't heard of anybody else having the inner body things, but I'm a masseuse and a cook. I'm a vegetarian. I've been, you know, working with cancer patients, and I had one of my good friends and a client who asked me to come and help him last year. And that was the first time that I had an interaction with the orbs and actually somebody else. So I was there the second day I flew to L.A. to help him. His mother had passed away. His name is Gary Pops. And then his dad had a three-way bypass and so wasn't able to help him. So I flew into L.A. And the second day that I was there, I said, Gary, you know, all the orbs are here. And he was like, let's see what they want. Well, they ended up taking, this was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, too. It was in the daytime. They took my hands and put my hands, like if you put your hands together, just your fingertips, and then kind of separate your hands, and it kind of looks like an upside-down heart.
Yeah.
And they brought me straight into his body, straight up to his neck. He had throat and stomach cancer. And I could see my hands filling up with this light, and then they would throw me back across the room to, like, shake it off and then bring me back. And, I mean, Gary, you know, the two of us are going, wow, this is pretty interesting. Wonder what it all means. And then that happened for about 15 minutes, and then it would go around his body, on the core of his body, and, like, my hands would fill up with the light. And then it would throw me back and kind of shake my hands over my head. And that happened, for, you know, each time for about 20 minutes. And then within the time that I was there with him, it happened more than 20 times. And then what I didn't know is that Gary was planning to euthanize himself. And so the 2 days before he euthanized himself, on a Sunday, but on that Friday and Saturday night at 2:30 in the morning, there were thousands of orbs that woke me up, and I was really kind of scared, and so I woke up his friend Mike that was also there 24 hours and said, Mike, you know, this is really strange, but the orbs are waking me up, and they want me to go out over Gary, and I'm scared because there's so many. Could you go out there with me? And he said yes, and so Gary was pretty much out of it, and the orbs, instead of doing what they did before, they just held my hands over his body, and I could see rainbows of thousands of them circling his body, going around his body. And that happened for like 2 hours, and then at the end of that, I could see two tornadoes coming out of his head, one going out of his head and one going into his head.
Which part of his head?
Just like right at the base, or right above his forehead.
Uh-huh.
And so, and Mike was sitting there, and of course he can see just a little bit of a light, but the whole time I was telling him what was going on, and then the next night, they did the same thing. Well, I didn't know that Gary was going to euthanize himself, and they sent me out shopping, and when I came back, he was already in the process of doing it, and I think that the orbs knew, and I don't know if that was their way of preparing him or not.
Well, you think they were trying to save him from doing that?
I think they were. I think that's what it felt like.
And he didn't want. He wasn't convinced that he was able to be healed.
You know what? From the minute that he found out that he had the cancer, he only looked for to euthanize.
Uh huh. And not to heal. That was not a choice that he wanted to heal. I mean, of course.
Right.
He
didn't really do anything to try to get better. You know.
Uh huh.
He went for chemo for about a week, I think, and then that was about it. I don't know how much longer he would have lived. I mean, it seemed like, I don't know how far off he was, but, you know, he just decided he just didn't want to deal with it.
You think the orbs were trying to just make his transition easier, or were they actually trying to heal him?
I think that they did, because the day that he died, he looked the happiest that he's ever been.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, I was really amazed at the smile that I saw on his face. I was really sad that he did it, but it's his choice. But I really believe in the beginning that the orbs, and this is the weird thing, because Gary lives in Mexico, and he was like one of the only people that really continued to phone me. And I always went to his house, and I always saw the orbs, but see, I didn't understand what was happening. And I think that maybe they were there before to heal him. It's just that we didn't get it.
and that he wasn't open to that either. You have, you sort of have
right,
to be
but,
open.
You know, I was running scared, like I said, for about a year and a half, and it wasn't. Right. I just found out about that they were actually something about 2 months before I went to work with Gary. And so that is when actually I started feeling like I didn't really have to run, and I was really trying to understand what was happening instead of trying to really run from it.
But and now so, you're using this to heal other people. Talk about that process of what happens
well,
when you work with the orbs and healing.
It's, you know, the thing is I do massage and I do things like that, you know, exercising with people and stuff like that. But I really, you know, the orb thing, you really can't. It's a very hard thing for other people to understand. It took me a long time to understand it, and I don't think that a lot of people are really in touch. I have these clients and friends, dear friends of mine in Cabo San Lucas that I've worked with for like 15 years. Their names are the Broomsmas, Sue and Jerry, and they have a daughter, Brianna, who is, I started massaging her at 2, and she's now 16. And she wants to, you know, wanted to go to Sedona so she could find out all about the orbs. They're very open.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been seeing them. Like, I don't go, I'll give you an orb healing. I don't do that. But if the orbs come in...
You
and
could, though.
Somebody,
you could.
But I don't think I could because I think they decide who they want to heal.
I see.
Not me. And so, you know, there was once when I was at their house and Sue's had that ankle and the orbs flew in. And, you know, I mean, I could feel heat between me, myself, and the body, and I could see light.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen other tornadoes coming out of people. I did a couple healings on my mom, and a huge one flew out of her hip. And I've seen, you know, different kinds of gray matters coming in and out of people, but mostly coming out. I've only seen the real big tornado at the one time with Gary.
Huh.
And
so these are energies leaving people, not just also coming into them to heal them.
Right,
right,
right. Right. And a really good thing that I'd like to say about that is that, you know, I mean, I was running scared, so I don't really tell a lot of people about it. But at certain times that I feel open to it, I'll suggest it to the person. And there's a lady who I've been seeing in the last 6 months that I met, and I've been trying to meet her. She's 100 years old in October 16th. And when the time that I met her, I went into her room. Her daughter finally said, "You can, you know, why don't you eat your breakfast?" Because they own a restaurant down the Baja and in El Rosario. And then when you're done, I'll take you in so you can meet my mother.
Uh-huh.
And when I went in there to see her, she was sitting at her chair, and she had a respirator over her mouth. And I didn't know if she spoke English or anything. So in my best Spanish, I went in to say hi to her, and then all of a sudden, within 2 minutes of being in there, thousands of orbs flew in. And so I stood up in front of her, and I said, "I hope," in Spanish, "you know, I hope you don't think I'm crazy, but I have these energies following me, and I think they want to help you." So I put my hands in front of her, and I could see the orbs fly in between us, and I could feel the heat, and they took my hands around her body, and then all of a sudden, about after 15 minutes, she took her respirator off, and she said, "Oh, this is the gift that God has given you." Not with no seconds of even thinking about it. And she said, "This is the best that I felt in 4 months. When can you come back?" Well, I've done 4 healings on her now, and the last time that I just drove down the Baja, and she recognized me. She said, "How do you want me to sit? How would you like me to position my body to accept the healing?" And they flew in and did their thing, and I had dinner and slept overnight and went home the next day.
So they helped her, they healed, they helped bring some. And so did they fly into your body or into the patient's body?
I feel like it's kind of a both. Like, I kind of feel like they use me and they move my hands around the person's body. Like, I don't, like, this is a really, really strange thing, too, is that I don't go, "Okay, this person's leg is hurt," or "this person's whatever." They know where the person is, and they take my hands right to that area. And my friend who I'm staying with up in Lake Tahoe, his dog was hit by a car, was ran over by a Big Mac truck, and I've been giving the dog some orb healings, and the dog lays there and loves it.
You see the orbs around the dog
as
well.
Yeah, and then they come in, and they have tried to heal the dog also.
Wow,
so
you have a real gift for something.
Yeah, you know, and I wonder what my limitations are. You know, once Oh, there's a couple weird things that happened when I was with Gary. One time I was, you know, I saw the orbs fly in, and I said, Gary, you know, the orbs are here. And he said, okay, bring it on. So I put my hands over, you know, him and whatever, and then they lead me into his body. And really what it was, the thing that I felt that time was I felt his sorrow.
Mm-hmm.
I felt his pain from his heart.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started to cry, like it started to well up in my eyes. Well, the tears never came out of my eyes. They just welled up over my eyes like contacts. And then when I looked at Gary's body, I could see through his skin. And I was telling Gary, this is so crazy. I think I have X-ray vision right now. And I could see through your skin.
And what
and
did you
kind
see
of freaking
through
me out,
his skin?
You know?
What did
and,
you see?
I could see everything almost. It seemed like
what
I
his
see.
Organs or what his energy.
I could see the organs. I could see like the blood running through his veins, and I kind of got scared. And so
why did
kinda,
you get scared?
Because it was the first time it happened, and I just didn't know. You know, I was all of a sudden it was something different,
yeah.
And then I didn't know. You know, and then that made me think. You know, I mean, what are the limitations on what to heal and how I could heal and how. I could help somebody, you know, and I don't know.
Why do you think there's limitations?
Why? Why do
yeah,
I think there's
why?
Limitations?
Yeah,
well,
why?
I just don't know. That's what I'm saying. I mean, I don't really understand totally everything that's happening to me.
Well, you're still in this phase of exploration and developing and developing a relationship, it sounds like, with the orbs and figuring out how you guys can work together. That's what it seems like to me.
Right.
It's a kind of an ongoing study where lots of new things can happen for
right,
you.
Right, right. And I'm way more open now, you know, and I'm not running scared anymore. And that's, I think, the key difference is that I'm opening myself up. And every day I have an experience with the orbs where they're taking me through these movements.
Mm.
And adjusting
you describe me. That. What happens when you're driving? Describe what happens.
Well, when I'm driving, you know what? Okay, this is one thing is because in the beginning when I was scared, they would come into my car a lot. And, I mean, I was just thinking, this girl's nuts. I am crazy. I'm seeing them in my car. They're trying to twist my neck all the time, you know. And and it's like almost like they have me at a time where they can come in and manipulate me, you know.
They have
and
you alone.
Have tell
they can
them,
do what they want. They'll
right.
Have their
that,
way with you, yeah.
That, you know, I'm driving, you know, and but they still continue to, like, wring my neck around and crack my neck. And when I'm out of my car and in different places and they start taking me through these tantra movements, and then now they're like almost bending me backwards and rocking me from side to side, which is a kind of weird, and I've almost felt myself levitate a couple times.
Wow.
It's like I was almost going to levitate.
I
like
want to see that. I'm going to bring you to New York to show people that.
Well, you know, each time though, okay, so each time that they take me through this movement, it really has never hurt me.
Uh-huh.
And then one day, about 6 months after I was really kind of loosening up to this, during the movement, it stopped me right in the middle of the movement and started taking me through my golf swing. And I was thinking, okay, this is kind of weird. So then all of a sudden, I got about up with my swing, you know, where my shoulder's up, and I'm kind of leaning to the side, and I'm screaming in pain.
Uh-huh.
I mean, excruciating pain. I'm in such pain that I'm crying, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, is this what's supposed to happen? Am I supposed to feel pain? And then it would bring me back down and then back up, and it happened about 12 times. And about the 12th time, all of a sudden, something adjusted my body, and there I am crying and thanking them again.
Wow.
And so it's like, you know, they're taking that injury. It feels really like they're unwinding all of the stuff that's on my body and getting rid of it.
And getting you prepared for some really major work for with other people, it sounds like.
Yeah, you know, but like I say, you know, they decide. I don't decide that I'm going to have an orb healing, and sure, you can come on in and get one, you know. But
right,
I think,
and these are tantric movements, too? In which way are they tantric?
The movement with me?
Yeah, you said, are they...
Because it takes me up and down and around, and then back and up and down and around, and like... It's like me trying to, you know, I mean, it's just, when you think about it, I mean, it's such an amazing concept that I'm having my own little trainers come in and train
me.
And not only are they doing that, I mean, I, sometimes, you know, I'm fighting it. At the same time, I'm still thinking I'm nuts, I'm crazy, what's happening, you know. And then when I finally can give in and loosen up, and to each of the movements, you know, I'm really getting adjusted in myself. And I've asked them that, you know, and people always say, you know, well, do you talk to them? And I go, well, you know, yeah, I try to talk to them. I ask them questions. My thing that I've always asked them for is language. Can you give me the language so I can understand you and other people around the world? Give me that, you know, if you're doing these fly-ins, you know, can you leave me with a little bit of knowledge also about language, you know? So, yeah, I do talk to them.
I think it's beyond language. It's more about feeling. It's about, talking to them in a telepathic, intuitive way and seeing what they're here for and what they're...
And this is why I could say that I don't believe they're ghosts, because I think if there were a ghost or some kind of scary entity or whatever it was, they would just be at my house.
Right.
They wouldn't be following me around the world, you know. And, I mean,
no,
I have thousands of them following me.
And you see them every day. And they sound like they're a really strong healing force. And it's somehow connected to your destiny to bring these through and work with them, with people.
Yeah. I think the more people also open themselves up to the idea that I have these energies, that they won't be so scared either. Because I think I had a friend that kind of just said it all to me. He's like, yeah, I really want you to come over to my house, but are your energies going to start following my kids?
And I think that's why a lot of people are kind of scared.
And
They're there anyway, though. They're all around us all the time. I've taken pictures around everybody. There's these
right. But that's what I'm saying. I mean, I'm talking about people who don't know what an orb is, or studied an orb, or you know, never cared to know what an orb is. And when I come and say, "Hey, I got orbs following me," they're like, "Hey, I don't know if I want you to come to my house." You know, I have
keep your friends outside.
Go ahead and come over, but leave those things outside. You know,
but it's just ignorance in a way, because they really are everywhere, and they really are. I don't know if they're a new phenomenon, but they seem to be making themselves more and more apparent.
Right?
I mean, they probably have always been here.
I'm. Even though I'd like to say that I'm really that comfortable with it, sometimes I'm not. When there's thousands of them around me, I'm wondering what they're trying to tell me, and maybe I'm just not getting it.
Slowly you're getting something. I mean, do you feel stuff inside your body when they're doing these strange movements with you?
Yeah, I do. I feel them inside of me.
What kind of stuff are you feeling? Are you feeling good, like elation?
Yeah, I see, when I'm driving a lot, I see these little molecules that look like little X and Y chromosomes flying, and then I see them, you know, and then all of a sudden they start twisting my neck around, you know, and I can fight it. I can tell them no. I can tell them, you know, not right now. I'm driving down a, you know, windy road. This isn't the time. But then other times, you know, I mean, I was driving three hours, and they were with me practically the whole way.
Uh-huh. And doing what? Just moving me
and twisting my head to the side. You know, I mean, I look in the rearview mirror. I see them coming up behind me. I get in a plane. I look out the window. There they are.
Really?
Wow.
So you see them every day. Every day they're there. But they're not there all the time. They come and go.
They come and go, yeah.
And is there certain moments or times of day? It sounds like in the afternoon they're there more, huh?
No, I can wake up in the morning and see, like this morning I woke up and saw them. You know, but they don't stick around me all the time, you know. But every day they try to take me through the movement of adjusting me. And a couple times I felt like, because I'm a surfer, I felt like I was in a wave. Like I could close my eyes and I can see. And I'm moving at a more erratic movement. And then something cracks, you know, and there I am saying thank you again.
Do they look familiar? Is it the same ones visiting every day?
That's one thing, you know, when it first started happening, I saw my dad's been passed away for quite a few years, but I did see my dad's face in it four times.
Uh-huh.
And that kind of freaked me out. I kind of started screaming, you know, don't use my dad to get to me. This isn't going to work, you know.
But do you think it could have been your father?
I think it could have been. And that's what I ask myself, you know, if I'm around people and I see the orbs, you know, are these orbs for these people, you know? Do they want to say something? You know, because I've, since it's been happening to me and since I got electricity, I tend to watch the psychic shows or anything that's kind of off the normal track and to see, and, you know, and it's very interesting to see, like, Lisa Williams, how she has, you know, and can see these deceased people, you know, and passing on their words of what they want to communicate to the people.
Seems way beyond that kind of astral phenomenon. It seems like a much higher level of consciousness, in the sense that they're coming through and they're healing and they're uplifting you. It just sounds like, to me, a little different than just those people have passed on.
Oh, yeah, but I've always just wondered how those people started in their field of getting in touch with these energies and not being scared of them and really embracing, you know, their gift and being able to have people around them that also embrace that, you know. You know, unfortunately, I have a lot of, and I've been open without electricity, and I'm not in touch with that kind of guru-type stuff, though it interests me, but I'm, you know, pretty much have been living out in the sticks, it seems like. So I'm really fascinated with the fact that all these other people are, you know, in touch with their energies.
I've talked to Jay-Z 9 and been part of that Rantha school for a long time. When she first saw Rantha appear as this pillar of light, this, you know, glittering figure, she was freaked out for like 2 years. She couldn't deal with it.
Oh, really?
And slowly she started to get used to the idea that this being was around, and it was a whole process of their developing a kind of interaction until the time where she was then able to channel this being. And there's a lot of people who are freaked out when phenomena first happens to them. But on another level, soul is ready for it. So it's like that struggle between the personality and the soul that's happening.
Well, yeah, you know, because you have friends and family, and you don't want to be a part of that.
Well,
and I think that's
maybe, but that's just the mundane world. I mean, perhaps your destiny is for something else, you know?
Well,
I mean, doesn't mean you can't have friends and family. It just means, like, you're here to help with something beyond just that kind of ordinary phenomena. You know, you're not ordinary anymore.
Thank you, Ellen, for saying that.
No, it's true. I never thought
I was ordinary, but it's
It's time, like, you're not normal. You can't fit. I mean, it's not that you can't fit in, but it's like there's something that's been activated in you that's bringing, it's an awakening in you, it seems like.
It is definitely an awakening, and it's definitely, for me, coming to grips with what's happening. You know, you really have to, the one really true lesson that I learned in the whole incident is that you have to believe in yourself, and through that you can generate love and energy for other people.
And I think acceptance of who you are, and you know that, you know, you don't like to feel maybe special in an egoic way, but something that you've been gifted with is happening.
And I do call them angels, you know. I do call them orb angels. I call them the British, my British angels.
Right.
But I do have two experiences where they saved me.
Oh, yeah? Tell us.
One time when I was driving down the Baja and I was by myself. I normally drive by myself, and I have a mannequin that drives with me, so nobody thinks I'm by myself. And it was about 12 o'clock in the afternoon, and I thought I was tired, but I thought, oh, it's in the daytime. I'm really not that tired, and keep driving. And then all of a sudden, I felt like something slapped my forehead and woke me up, and I was, you know, almost drove off the cliff, and it was the orbs. They woke me up and already turned the steering wheel, and I pulled over and just said thank you and started doing jumping jacks and drinking water and stood there. I got my hula hoops out and started hula hooping on the side of the road till I really woke up. And it got too hot. And then I got back in the car and I just was thinking to myself, gosh, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. And every time I do drive down the Baja, I'm amazed at how many orbs I see and how safe my trip is and how everything works out. And I had another time I was eating popcorn and I was with my mom in her room and I was looking at my mom pointing at my chest going, I'm choking, you know, slap me on the back. I can't. I got popcorn lodged in my throat. And so my mom just barely hits me on the shoulders because she thinks I'm joking. And I say, no, I'm turning blue now. You know, I'm choking. And I could feel the orb go inside of me and lodge that. And I looked at my mom and I go, oh, it's out. The orb just saved me, you know. And we were both started crying. I was like, oh, my God, this is too crazy.
So they're actually, for you, these feeling, you can actually feel them then. There's a kind of a sensory, it's not just visual, the orb thing for you.
No. And I mean,
I can reach out and touch
them. Like I said, I think I need glasses, though. I lose them all the time. But I can swear, because I think I'm nearsighted, but I can see an orb flying, you know, 1,000 feet out of the sky.
And how big are they usually? I mean, because they seem all different
sizes.
They change
in size, and also they change in appearance.
What do you mean, they pulsate?
Well, they, like, seem to take, like, whatever, when you know, like, if I'm in a room and I look up and I see, like, a light bulb or something, or a light fixture, they'll take that pattern, actually, almost, and then they'll look around. But if I look at and they see the TV, well, they'll take a square shape. Or, you know, I mean, and, you know, I've had so many crazy stories, and I actually was writing a journal, and I ended up burning it because I read it, and I burned it because I thought that people would think that I was crazy because
you shouldn't
burn
them because they're valuable for people to read that.
Well,
it doesn't matter if people think you're crazy. Just, I think you should keep a journal because I think it is developing in you. But what were you going to say?
Oh, and so, you know, I mean, you say that, I keep forgetting to write it down when it happens because it happens so frequently that I just don't walk around with a book writing it down. But I think the orbs have definitely some message to give, and I keep asking them, do you want to do like an exercise class where we bring them all in and you start moving them all around too and adjusting them and like their own little chiropractors.
And what do they say about that?
It hasn't happened yet, but, you know, I've been around my friends, a couple friends that are comfortable with me, and when it's happened, it's really strange because I've asked a lot of people to film me, but nobody has.
Film you. That's why we're going
to
bring you to New York.
Nobody wants to because I think they're a little scared of what they might perceive, or I'm not quite sure, but in the last year and a half, I've probably asked a dozen people to try to see if I could, you know, just look at myself and see how it's doing, you know, I mean, when you're in the actual movement yourself, I'm really not thinking of that. I'm thinking about what's happening to me and how they're adjusting me and how, I mean, it's been a couple times, like, I've really bent over backwards, you know, I'm thinking, oh, my God, I'm going to fall over, and then I kind of freak out, and then I'll lift myself up, and like I said, levitating, you know, that is kind of scary, because when you're bent over, and then all of a sudden your toes come off the ground, and you're just there, and you're like, you know, it's freaky. It's a kind of weird feeling that you're, you have to trust, you know, and then trust in them.
Well, I'm looking forward to videotaping you and...
oh, yeah, me too. I'd be interested to see if your camera...
I think so. And then just bringing you and having you speak about that subject in New York, I think, could be very exciting.
Yeah, you know, when I went to Sedona, I had a couple incidents when I was inside there, and I could see all the orbs flying around, and, you know... And then we took pictures, and you could see them actually there, too, also. So that was kind of neat, you know, to say, oh, I see an orb, and then they take a picture, and there would be. I definitely think they're here to help us.
I'm just looking at my emails now, and it's something says the message is from the orbs. Just came through on my email, you know?
Uh-huh.
And so that's an interesting sign that... discover many people are having experiences about orbs and photographs, and it seems to be a worldwide phenomena.
I'd be interested to, you know, to talk to somebody else that's having these experiences, you know, that might be similar to what I'm doing, you know, to see if they're any more advanced in their development than I am, you know, to guide me in a direction that would help everybody. You know, I'm open, and I always say, you know, I take it, and I take it with all the white light of the Lord and the love, and I only accept the good energies, and in hopes that those were the energies that come through, you know, because I never really thought about good and bad energy, and it wasn't until I watched this movie, and, you know, since I just had electricity put in, I watched this movie called The Exorcism of Emily Rose, and it kind of set me in straight, and to know that I have angels following me around, and I have a real heart for this woman who experienced these evil energies that, you know, came in and then finally killed her, and I'm really grateful that mine are loving energies and of light, and that.
Well, that's because of who you are. You know, you would only attract those types of energetic.
But I don't think I don't think she was a bad person, is what I say. And I have a feel that, you know, I'm just grateful that mine are loving energies. You know, I'd be walking and then all of a sudden they'd pull my hair.
Right.
Or something like kind of jumps out at you, you know, that really isn't there. You know, it's like they're trying to get my attention.
Right.
And you know, like at other... I'm sorry, excuse me.
No, I was just going to say in this book that this, what this in this email, this woman named Meg Blackburn Losey is an intuitive and talking to orbs, and she says that these her interests are in different types of children coming to the planet, and the orbs have attached themselves to her energy field, and she discovered each orb carried the consciousness of a different child, and they were talking to her. And when she asked questions about humankind, they said, here is some of what they had to say about, they said, about life on Earth. These were children of the, in the form of orbs, said, I remember what it was like before I came here. Everyone told the truth and no one got hurt. Anyway, she's sort of saying about relationships, I wish people could see what they're doing to each other. Maybe then they would learn to treat each other better. I mean, these are just sort of general messages, but these are messages that orbs are giving this woman.
Right, and also there's another lady who I saw in San Francisco. She lives in Hawaii. Her name is Nedra.
Uh-huh.
And she's been channeling these orbs through her, and they come out in an actual voice.
Uh-huh.
And I thought,
and what did she say about your stuff?
She didn't really have a lot of interest. She didn't really have a lot to say about me, actually. And, you know, and most of it was about the planet and how we're affecting it and how we need to be on a straight line. But I didn't really, I asked, you know, about my situations, and she didn't really have a lot to say, you know.
Well,
but
there's a channel I know in New York who will be able to tune into you for sure. She works with different types of healers, so we'll videotape that. We'll do a videotape.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Yeah, I think.
So, you know, when you gave your, I'm really interested in on your
orb conference.
On your orb conference, and on how you found these people to come in and actually speak, and what their involvement with the orbs were. You know, because I went on the internet, you know, after the first year to try to find answers, and I'd get on there, and you know, I'm still, I don't know anything about internet. You know, I just got email. I know how to barely type, and I would get into these places, and people would, don't even care what you talk about. They don't even want to hear about the orbs or whatever. And I was just really interested on how these people are associated with orbs also. Like, I see orbs right now. I see two orbs, three orbs, four orbs. Now, they're coming in. They look like small little round balls of light.
What
they're
color?
Lighter. They're white.
They're white.
These ones are white. Now, I see them. Okay, and when I was with the lady who was 100 years old, my girlfriend and I came out of her room, and I said, oh, the orbs are here. And she said, are there two little pink ones? And I said, yeah, they're pink. Do you see them? And she goes, oh, yeah, I see them. Okay, well, she's been my friend for, I don't know, 15 years. And she, you know, kind of, not that she doubted me, but she's been open to it. And I gave her a couple orb healings at her house, and her four-year-old daughter put her hands out and said I could heal too. And it was really beautiful that she was able to see them. And there were, like, six or seven little pink ones, you know. And so, like I do, they come in different colors. These ones are whiter. And I think I have about 20 to 30 in the room right now that I could see.
Are they listening to the conversation?
I don't know if they're listening, but, you know.
Well,
I bet they do. I really feel like they somehow communicate with me. Like I said, you know, when it first started happening, I felt like they were talking to me subliminally. And then when they started singing that song to me, I thought, oh, gosh, this is crazy. How do they know this song? You know, and I haven't heard the song in 20 years, you know. How do they know it?
Well, this is, I mean, I've met the people like you because I'm interested in what this show is about called New Reality. So I search out people who are open to these types of things because I know we're in the middle of some sort of revolution or an evolution of consciousness, and all these phenomena are part of it. And so you're fitting, you're kind of leading the way in your individual communications or experiences for people to have these types of experiences in the future.
Right. So, well, I hope that people learn from definitely my experiences, may open their hearts up to these energies and find that they definitely are here, I really, truly believe, to help us.
Yeah.
And even though I might not have all the answers and all the pictures in it, but I really feel like it's a good thing. And if it was a bad thing, I would be running.
No, it doesn't feel like it's a bad thing. It feels like it's an uplifting experience.
No, it doesn't feel like it's bad at all. That's what I say.
Yeah.
It's definitely a loving energy. And like I say, I do believe that everybody has them. It's just not everybody can see them, and hopefully
and,
they will.
And maybe
like
at
said,
some point they will.
That's what I say, and I have my girlfriend. She says, "Oh, I'm so glad that I saw it." Mm. You know, and
I've seen them. I've seen them and sense them. I mean, not like you, not all the time, but I see a blip of a white light here or something. Sometimes, usually above people's heads, they'll just flash on and off or something. Just certain people, but maybe this is the shift in vibration that some people are just ahead of the curve in a sense. You know,
right, right.
But
I am open up to all the great people that you have that are out there. You know, that are going to be around you and that are going to be sending you these emails and stuff.
I'll send you
to
this
really
email.
Find out how they feel about it and if they've had, interactions with these orbs and have come into contact with whatever other energies that are out there to help us.
I'm going to forward you this email, and you give us an ongoing orb update, okay?
Okay.
I appreciate it. No, thank you, Leanne. And
so welcome. Thank you for letting me actually speak about it. It's very nice to have somebody that wants to hear about it and to know what's going on, because it definitely is an out-of-this-world experience, and I happen to think that I'm a very lucky person to be experiencing it. Even though it was very frightening in the beginning, as I embrace it, I really believe how lucky that I am. And
yeah,
I hope I could spread this luck and this energy and these loving lights to other people to help them. I'm all for it.
You're doing it. You're absolutely doing it, because you're keeping your heart open and you're just trusting. You're trusting in the unknown, and I think you're going to be helping a lot of people with this experience. So thank you for being a guest.
Well, I look forward to coming to New York and having more of these Orby talks.
Definitely, and we'll set up a lecture. I'll let people know about Leanne coming to New York, and they want to email me. You can email newrealities@earthlink.net. I've been talking to. How do you spell your last name again?
It's Craggs.
And that's
Leanne.
Right, Craig. So, thank you, Leanne, for being
thank
a guest.
Thank you so much, Alan, and I look forward to hearing from you again.
Okay, you can listen to the song and play this closing song called The Song of the Soul, which I like to kind of close with. I just want to tell people they've been listening to New Realities every Tuesday night on BBS Radio at 7 p.m. West Coast time, 10 p.m. East Coast time. You can look at my website, newrealities.com, or email me at newrealities@earthlink.net. My name's Alan Steinfeld, and thank you for listening.
Feliz Navidad.
Thanks.